Jerry, Russell, how's it going today, guys?
It's warm here.
What happened? I heard you had like a flood in your office.
Yeah, my I have a pair of skylights in my office. I actually chose this room for my office specifically because of all of the sunlight that came into this room because I spent 10 years working underground in a server room. So when we bought this house, I wanted this room to be my office specifically because of the sunlight. But apparently when you have sun, you also have water. And so I have had several incidents since buying this house where water has tried to come into my office full of things that do not like water. And the skylight is the latest in that adventure.
Jerry, doesn't sun heat water to the point where it evaporates and therefore is no longer a problem, or is my physics all wrong there?
I think you need like a lot more sun than water.
Sun just isn't hot enough. Maybe in West Virginia it'll be hot.
No, it's not hot here today, thankfully.
Well, I don't know how hot it is in Berlin, but I'm so happy to welcome our special guest this week, Martin. And I'm going to pronounce your name wrong. I'm sorry, Martin Barca. Barza?
Pretty close. It would be Martin Barca.
Barca. Okay. Yeah. That's the Hungarian in the name. Welcome, welcome, welcome. Thank you for joining us. How are you?
Happy to be on the show. I'm doing very well. It's not too hot in Berlin. It's just comfortable t-shirt weather.
I was in Berlin in June in 2013, and it was amazing. It was like perfect every day, like 20, 21, 22 degrees. That's Celsius for the Americans in the room. And Martin, you are the host and owner extraordinaire of a YouTube channel called Tech Alter. And you make really smart videos on, you know, the tech industry, phones. And before we get started, I just want you to kind of give us a quick explanation of what it is you do, because I know after the show, people are going to run and check out all your videos.
I hope they will. So I have a YouTube channel, as you said, and it's on consumer tech. So all the same stuff that you guys talk about, except for also, I don't know, Windows and Apple and whatever else. And yeah, I do all the same device coverage that everyone else does in the industry as well. But as you said, I also try to focus more on the industry trends, the companies behind the products, their business strategies, their marketing strategies, and that sort of stuff.
So I came across your videos about a year ago when your video called "Why Enthusiast Brands Will Betray You" it went a little bit viral. It got picked up by Reddit and a couple other places, and I really enjoyed your explanation on why companies like Pebble and Nextbit and Cyanogen end up disappearing. And then, you know, you've gone on to make YouTubing your full-time job, right? It's recently become a big change for you.
That's correct. I switched to being a full-time YouTuber about, I think maybe 2 months ago or so. So before that, I worked in various tech jobs. And then about 2 months ago or so, I decided to go all out and do this as my main gig.
Well, congratulations. Yes. And you shaved off all your hair at the same time.
I wanted to look more like you, so I had to.
Right. And you and I first met, I think, at MWC at a Nokia briefing.
That's correct.
Where they were talking about the Nokia 7 Plus and the 6.1 and all the 2018 Nokias. And then again in Korea, we met up and had a great time touring around Seoul and Jeju Island with the G7. So I wanted to bring you on to talk a little bit about your experience in tech and making videos, but also to focus on the EU, the European Commission fine that was levied against Google this week, which is a big deal and something that we're going to get into shortly. It's a $5 billion fine that Google has 90 days to pay or try to find a way to fix. And Jerry and Russell, you guys have been in the trenches of this for months now. So we'll get your insights as well.
And I have to admit here that I didn't have any very strong opinion on this topic before you told me I'd be on the podcast. So I spent the last day and a half just researching this and coming up with stuff that I could intelligently say about it. So hopefully it'll be fun.
I hope you had enough aspirin. It's crazy.
It is pretty crazy, yeah.
So I appreciate that, as I knew you would too, because whenever I see one of your videos, Martin, I know how much research goes into each one and how deliberate they are. So we'll get to that after the break. But guys, I want to talk a little bit about the story that Bloomberg put out today about Fuchsia. And Fuchsia is this open source project that we've talked about on the site before, but it's a new operating system that Google is sort of they're positioning it to eventually replace Android. At least that's what the story was from Bloomberg today. And Jerry, you've been covering Fuchsia forever since its earliest days as just a Git repository. So give us the lowdown on what it was, what it is, and what it potentially will be in that five-year period that Bloomberg is saying.
Let's try to do this the easy way. You have to realize that the phone you have in your hand that you say is an Android phone, Android doesn't have to be an operating system. Android can be forked to run on Windows. It can, you know, Android is a... It can be a self-contained application framework. What runs underneath it that controls the hardware and lets the user talk to the software through the hardware is what Fuchsia started as. It's they call it a microkernel and some utilities. So the hardware will turn on and it will respond to your input and be able to provide you with output. It's grown. It's grown a lot. It's got some really nice things. It's got some complicated, crazy things, you know, from the developer standpoint. But it is definitely poised to be a base. The actual operating system of every product that Google sells, Google Wi-Fi could run Fuchsia. Your phone could run Fuchsia. A Chromebook could run Fuchsia. But your Chromebook will still look like a Chromebook when you turn it on. Your phone will still look whatever Google's vision of Android is in 5 years when you turn it on, because what's running on top of it doesn't necessarily need the base that it has now. It can run on anything. So it's a way to get rid of Linux and a way to push Java to the fringes and introduce new programming languages is what it is.
Okay, so this is not necessarily going to make Android look different. This is not an external thing that Google is making to replace how Android looks. It's more of a way to make whatever Android eventually turns into run better on all the devices that Android currently runs on, not just phones.
Correct, and to unify all these. You've got a... You know, I'm not sure what embedded operating system things like Google Home use. But you've got Chrome, you've got Android, you've got Google uses their own version of Linux for programming in-house. If you could unify all of that, so from the development team to the end product is all running the same base operating system, it'll be better for everyone.
So, Russell, as part of this Bloomberg piece, there's a part that stuck out to me, and it said that at the moment, Android, which was developed when phones were just beginning to use touchscreen, is also not built to handle the type of voice-enabled apps that Google sees as the future of computing. So Fuchsia is being developed with voice interaction at its core. And that struck me as really fascinating, because as ubiquitous as Android phones are today, it has 90% of the smartphone market share. Google is really betting its hat on voice as the way that we're going to interact in the future with most of our tech, right? Is that something you actually see coming into existence, or is this just another company attempting to push a use case on people that may not be comfortable with it?
No, we're already starting to see kind of the beginnings of this happen everywhere around me. I can't go pretty much anywhere in around this area without seeing somebody using their voice to control their phone to do something already. A lot of times it's just speech to text to send someone a message, which has been a noted uptick in the last 6 months to a year, as opposed to prior, where I would just never see it. Now I see it all the time. But with the dramatic increase in virtual assistants, particularly in the home, voice commands in a way that, you know, kind of makes sense to use, where it just kind of feels natural to speak to your computer, is absolutely what's going to happen next. I have no doubt about that.
Martin, what's your take on this? Because when I was in Barcelona for MWC in March, I was amazed at the number of people using WhatsApp voice memos to communicate as their like primary form of, quote, text messaging. And it doesn't seem to be as popular here in North America, but in Europe, that seems to be the entrenched way that a lot of people communicate.
I'd go even further one step and say that the place where this is even much more crazy than Europe is China. So I think already in 2013, 14, when I was in China, basically everyone used WeChat and they'd be too lazy to type anything out using their keyboard. So they just send voice commands, and not voice commands, but voice messages. And I absolutely hated them. But everyone over there was super excited about this. And I think it's definitely going to increase. One of the interesting use cases that I heard of is that I'm making a story on KaiOS right now, which is the OS that is running on the Nokia Banana phone and on the Jio phone in India. And apparently KaiOS is a really strong place for voice assistants, because if you don't have a very good input method, right? They don't have touch screens. They have those num pads, and you have a large population of people who are not very comfortable with navigating like a complex visual UI, or let's say a lot of them are illiterate, which a lot of feature phone users tend to be. Then suddenly, just being able to tell your phone what you want it to do becomes a very valuable input method. But for the mainstream computing needs of most people in the West, who are at least between a certain age group and have a certain level of familiarity with technology, I just don't think voice is a very practical way of interacting with a device, other than doing it occasionally for a few tasks, but like as your main input method. I don't really see how that could be happening.
Voice takes away your privacy.
That too, yeah.
That's my problem with it. It's if I'm on the subway and I want to talk to my wife or a friend or something, I can type and nobody else hears what I have to say. It's like a phone call. You know how upset you get when somebody on the bus or somebody in a restaurant is talking loudly on the phone? Well, that's because you're not interested in what they're doing. And that's how I feel about voice communication.
It's absolutely true. And it is so bizarre here to see very public criticism, mocking people who are sitting in a Starbucks and they just, instead of picking up the phone that is right there next to their cup of coffee, they will just say, "Hey Siri," and start talking to their iPhone.
Yeah.
like right there in the middle of a handful of people sending a text message to whoever. Every single time I leave the house now, I see someone doing it.
It's so definitely easier, but easy isn't everything.
Okay, so Fuchsia is going to have low-level voice support, which means that it's likely not going to be resource-intensive, that element of it. But why do this, Jerry? Why push a new, a custom kernel, this kernel called Zircon, which is it's Bloomberg says going to eschew many of the older technologies in Linux and potentially make a lot of devices incompatible with it. Why fork or move away from the Linux kernel that's been running Android for 10 years now? What is it about that is limiting to what Google sees as the future of computing, aside from voice?
Linux was designed back when computers were 3 feet tall. Google had to do a lot of work to make it even operate on a smartphone. You know, and not just Google, they had partners that helped. And the Linux kernel is huge. It's built to work with almost any, you know, electronics that has a decent processor. And now that's great. That's great for, you know, repurposing old hardware, or it's great for the third world. But when you want to go forward, that means you have to sift through all of that, pull out what you need, and then try to shoehorn your new ideas into it. And it's probably actually easier to just start from scratch. Look, we want to build a kernel and some utilities that are designed specifically to run a handheld touchscreen voice-operated device. You could do that with Linux, but it's a lot of work. And if you're going to put in that work, you might as well build something that's going to be a little better.
A little better is one thing, but this is a long-term project. It's been in the works since 2016. It's expected to continue well into 2021, 22 before we even see it on commercial devices. This, you know, Google has come out and said there is no timeline for Fuchsia. They rejected the 3 to 5 year timeline that Bloomberg's article supposes. But at the same time, you'd expect that even though Google is working on a lot of open source projects, it is going to try to make this into a thing, a big deal. Whether or not it takes over Android or whatever comes after Android, you'd expect that they're investing millions of dollars of resources into this for a reason.
Oh, certainly. And we have to remember that I think the first Android phone was released in 2008. And I imagine Andy Rubin and company had been working on Android for at least 5 years, you know, prior. It's not easy to build something like a smartphone operating system or the underpinnings of an operating system. It's extremely complicated, and it'll be filled with errors that'll need fixed. It's a lot of work, and it's going to take time.
So my question then is, what happens to the devices before and after? I mean, we're going to have smartphones well into that transition period. It's not like they're just going to disappear. Do Android phones just not get updated to the software that runs on Fuchsia devices? Like, how is that going to work? And I know that it's 5, 7 years away, but how do you see it working?
Well, I imagine, let's be hypothetical here, a Google branded device that runs Android as it is today, 5 years from now, will probably be compatible and will be able to upgrade to, you know, showcase what they've got. But your hardware OEMs, it's going to be the end of platform level updates. That doesn't mean Samsung can't continue to improve their versions of Android and release updates to you and try to incorporate new features. But coming from Google, I'm going to say yes, that Android is dead. When the first phone releases that runs a new operating system, and I hate using that term, Android is finished as far as Google is concerned. It's not worth the resources to maintain both.
Russell, the one thing that comes to mind is, remember when Samsung released the first generation Galaxy Gear? And that ran on it ran on Android, but it was kind of a forked version of Android that didn't resemble what we saw on phones, nor did it resemble Android Wear. It was its own thing. And then it got an over-the-air update to Tizen, but it looked exactly the same. There was very little visual distinction between the two. It's only that the low-level resources we're running this new operating system or this new kernel. That kind of sounds to me like what Jerry's talking
yes.
about.
And that's a great point because Tizen, Tizen, you can say it either way, will run Android apps. So it's an Android device in that level, whereas it can run Android applications.
Martin, what's your take on this? I mean, do you have thoughts on Fuchsia and how it's going to play out in the long term?
Not very defined thoughts, to be honest. I haven't looked into this too much. I mean, the only parallel that I can remember that is kind of a parallel is that Microsoft back in the days was building their own new OS as well. I think they called it Midori or something like that, and that never got anywhere. So I don't know. I think it's too far ahead for me to say anything smart about it.
Well, that's the smartest answer. Thank you.
So you're saying Bloomberg shouldn't have published this?
No. I mean, they wanted to get the clicks. They got the clicks. We got something to talk about. It's all fine. There's no harm done, but I don't know. I can't speculate on this myself in an intelligent way.
It's interesting to a certain group of people, and I'm one of them, but, you know, any consumer-facing thing, I wouldn't be surprised if we never saw it. That's just as likely.
So one last thing that I want to touch on with Fuchsia is a business-related angle. And Russell, the Google had to pay out a lot of money to Oracle for violating Java patents that Oracle claims were proprietary and Google claims were free and open. And this is not going to be using anything to do with Java. I mean, how much of this is a business decision, something that they, you know, Google can free themselves up from the shackles of Oracle?
I think it goes further than any Oracle tethers. I think that the overall goal here is to have something that in every conceivable way is software that Google entirely owns. This goes beyond it being an open source project. This goes beyond it being, you know, from bits and pieces found elsewhere. Everything that we see so far about Fuchsia, and Jerry, correct me if I'm wrong, it's almost entirely like code line by line built internally, with very few resources borrowed from elsewhere.
Absolutely. It's all new.
So why make it open source then? Why expose that code in a Git repository? Why, you know,
there's still a lot of positivity from having an open source project from Google's perspective. There have been so many advancements in the way that Android has been run from upstream pushes from all of their partners, you know, Samsung and Motorola and LG, all of these companies, even the Cyanogen team when they were around and you know, a bunch of others. These upstream contributions made tremendous changes to the way Android functioned in the early days. And it's the only way that Google is going to be able to make sure that whatever Fuchsia is can compete with what Android is now on a kind of functional stability level in a short period of time.
And Google doesn't care if someone else uses it. Google only cares that they won't have to pay to use it themselves.
Plus, it's good for their image.
Sure. And open source, I think we've seen with all, you know, every day you turn around, there's a new vulnerability for your router or your phone or your TV or your toaster or anything. Open source code tends to get fixed within hours.
Interesting. Yeah, okay. So on the other hand, then when you leave the code, you know, when you leave the fixes to companies, so like there's this tension between Android, which is, you know, AOSP, there are companies that can voluntarily fix code and send it upstream. But then there's companies like Broadcom and Qualcomm, which we always hear complaints by the open source advocates that say they don't show their cards. They don't participate in this, you know, free and open discussion that the community really tries to engender. That they that they keep the best stuff for themselves because it is proprietary and because they need to. They need to monetize right. parts of it, right? And I wonder if in the future, you know, if the successor to Android is still advocating open source, it is still a fundamentally partner-driven business where the Samsungs and the LGs of the world are, and even, you know, the Xiaomis and the and Huaweis of the world are taking that code and making whatever they want from it. Is that not just going to repeat the same mistakes that happen with Android, that the updates don't come on, you know, often, that Google doesn't have the same amount of control as they would like?
When we saw the first Chromebook, my very first thoughts was, well, Google learned them from their mistakes with Android. A Chromebook is built on open source code, and if Samsung or Acer or whoever wants to build one, Google will assist in getting it up and running. But here is what you are allowed to do if you want to use the Chrome name.
Fair enough.
They can't release another Android. And Android isn't nearly as bad as its public image makes it look. But that public image is what drives consumers to look elsewhere.
Martin, Android is much more popular in Europe and China and India than it is in North America, right? In North America, it's a 50-50 split with iOS. But in Germany, for instance, it's a 90-10 split. You know, in China, there's, you know, the iPhone is a status symbol, but the number of phones that Apple sells is much less than Xiaomi or Vivo or Oppo. What is the perception of Android there? Is there the same scrutiny around updates, around security, as there is here?
In China, definitely much less. What I realized when I lived in China is that the average Chinese consumer, well, this is kind of true in the West as well, but the average Chinese consumer definitely does not know that their phone runs Android, and they definitely don't know which version of Android it runs and has never heard of the concept of Android versions in the first place. At most, they know that their phone runs MIUI or Emotion UI. Mm-hmm. And all these phone makers, because they don't have any tie-ins with any of Google's services, it's basically, apart from security patches, close to irrelevant which version of Android the phone is running on, right? They're so heavily skinned anyway, and all the Google services are removed anyway, that it practically doesn't matter. What matters is which software skin of the manufacturer you're on, and that's what they pay attention to. I'd say in Europe, the scrutiny is less intense, just because I feel like, in general, European customers tend to be less techie, in a sense. So there's just less interest in general on more intricate details of their OS. But there's certainly, I feel like, more of a mistrust of Google as both a privacy concern and as an antitrust concern, as I'm sure we'll soon talk about them soon.
Oh yeah, that's a really good place to transition. But Russell, you were going to say something.
No, I mean, it was perfectly covered there.
Oh, sorry. I thought I heard you. I thought I heard you go, "What?" And then I was like, "What?" And then the internet derped, and we all sighed. All right, so we're going to take our first break, and our only break, to the people who are complaining that we have too many ads. This is for you. This week, we're going to talk about Thrifter, as we've done every week. Thrifter covered Prime Day really well. They got you all the great deals, all the discounts, all the coupons, all the iTunes gift cards that sold in the millions, because that was insane. I think Amazon even gave away a bunch of money. If you refilled a gift card, they gave you a $25 credit. Like, they were just throwing money around. That's over, though, and the deals have slowed down, but they have not stopped. So as we do every week, we're going to go around and we're going to pick a deal. And I'll start with you, Martin, because I know that I like to put our guests on the spot. And what do you have in mind for your pick this week?
Okay, one question before I pick something. Does the thing that's listed here, do they ship to Berlin? Or is this...
I hope
this,
so.
US or Canada only? Because either way,
pretend that it ships to Berlin.
Okay, if it were to ship to Berlin, then I'd definitely go for the Philips Hue starter kit here. That's $100 instead of $150. Because I'm redecorating my office, which is my living room, which is where I shoot my videos. And I am right now investing into these colored light bulbs, so things look nicer. And $50 off sounds like a good deal.
Can I tell you a little? When I watch your videos, I think of a much more serious version of Between Two Ferns. because you literally have like two plants behind you as you're talking. I think it's great. I love your setup, actually. I love the neon light. How did you get that done, by the way? Because it's super, super cool.
There's a German company called Signs with a Y, because of course it has a Y. There's a German company called Signs that make custom neons. And you just send them a logo, you go around fixing small issues, and then they send you a neon sign. Really easy. I think it was like 700 euros or something like that. So it's not exactly cheap, but it's really cool. I'm really happy with the results.
Okay, well, that's my thrifter pick for the week, as long as they ship to Canada. I'm going to get my own Lloyd in neon lights. Sounds amazing. Cool. Yeah. Philips Hue. Love it. Definitely like a perfect starter smart light setup. Russell, what's your pick for the week?
Thrifter has the Nerf Rival Kronos 17500 blaster, which the Rival series, the thing that makes the Rival series of Nerf guns, I'm going to like weirdly nerd out about Nerf guns here for a second. The thing that makes the Rival series of Nerf guns cool is it has a pair of attachment rails on the top. It actually has an attachment rail on the back and an attachment rail on the front so that you can have a scope or crosshairs, but you can also have mounts for extra darts. So you don't have to like reach for somewhere for darts. You can just have them right there. But also the front and the back of the Rival can also be accessorized so that you can have a longer barrel put on them or you can have a collapsible stock put on the back. But it all breaks down. Like you start off with just this pistol that you can just kind of mess with, and that pistol is usually like $20 with like no maybe one or two Nerf darts. But this one is $12 now. So $12, you get a starter Nerf gun. You get like a pair of them, and you can run around your house twirling them around like you're from the Wild West, which is not a thing that I have done. And anyone who shows you photos is a liar.
Now, these are the ones you can change the spring and make the darts go like a million miles an hour, right?
These are super easy to mod, yeah. And let me tell you something. Oh. If you've never dipped into the world of Nerf modding, like fire up your YouTube because those people are bananas.
There's so much stuff on YouTube. It is bananas everything. Itself. Super cool. I love how much you love Nerf guns. It really warms my heart.
There's an entire cabinet in my living room that is just Nerf guns. That is total, like, you can't tell that it's Nerf guns so that like normal other adults can come into the house and be like, oh, this is a house where like human beings live. But as soon as those people aren't there, my kids know that like they can just grab the Nerf guns and surprise me when I come out of the office and just start up like a 20-minute Nerf war in the house.
I'm
where we're
jealous.
Just diving over couches and stuff.
I love how you're adulting right.
I'm not allowed to have Nerf guns. My wife has. It's a long story. Trust me, you don't want to know.
Boo.
But I'm forbidden from having a Nerf gun
since that probably last time.
It's probably the right decision.
Well, Jerry, what are you allowed to have if you could buy it from Thrifter?
Thrifter has the Acer Chromebook 15. It's a certified refurb. That means Acer, they probably didn't do the refurbishing, but they looked it over and approved it. And it's $225. I know most people don't want a big 15-inch laptop, but if you're one of the few people that does, this is a nice, it's a nice 1080p, nice screen on a laptop. I had one for a while, and it's a good deal for $225.
Well, you are the Chromecast king, so I believe it when you say that a deal is a good one. Yeah, I've used Acer Chromebooks in the past, and that one I haven't seen that one before, but I'm sure it's good.
Oh, it's like a, you remember the 15-inch MacBook Pros, the big aluminum block?
Oh, yeah.
That's what it reminds you of. It's nice. I like a 15-inch laptop, so I really liked it.
Well, my pick, I think, is Jerry approved, and I think he knows what it is. It's the Hi-Fi Man HE560 planar magnetic headphones. I've actually never listened to these, but because I've never been able to afford them before. They're $900, and they were discounted to $500, but right now you can get them for $300 at Adorama. Planar magnetic headphones, I'm not really familiar with the actual science behind why they sound better. I just know that I have a pair of Audie's planar magnetic headphones that are incredible. The sound stage is wide. It's lush. It's beautiful. The bass goes deep. And Jerry, do you want to give us like the 10-second elevator pitch on what makes planar magnetic better?
It's hard to say normally. The sound stage, it separates your audio so you can hear the drums individually. You can hear each instrument individually. You can hear the vocals individually, but it's beautiful blended together. You hear all the sound.
So it makes the premium price worth it, because people can't usually justify spending $300 on a headphone, never mind $900.
Yeah, it's a tough pitch at $900. Any headphones are. I mean, very few people will. But if you have a nice piece of audio equipment that can, output decent sound, you'll instantly notice a difference, and you'll like the difference.
And just to be clear, these are not wireless headphones. They
are
wired headphones, FTW. All right. Well, if you're interested in any of these deals, head to thrifter.com, sign up for their newsletter, check out their Twitter feed at Thrifter Daily, and follow them on at thrifter.com. And we thank them so much as usual. All right. We got 10 minutes before Russell has to go. So Russell will disappear like a wizard in the night, but we'll continue on when he does go. But our last segment of the show is going to be about the Google EU fine. It is a huge one. It's the biggest fine against a tech company that the European Commission has ever levied. And it is about Google's power. It's about its anti-competitive practices, reportedly. And it is about three particular products within the Google suite that ship on all Android phones that are certified for the Play Store. It is Google Search, Chrome, and the Play Store. It is not singling out anything else. It is not saying that Google has too much power with Maps or YouTube or Google Docs or anything else. It is specifically talking about these three products. Russell, you wrote a really interesting editorial about why this sucks and how we got here. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on it.
Yeah, so I mean, what this really comes down to is from my perspective, just a fundamental misunderstanding of how it is that these technologies work now. And I think that's not a good thing for Google. You know, the argument that the EU is bringing is that by having these applications in a way that they are bundled with all of these other things, it's anti-competitive. So search as a part of Google's products is something you can't really install another search engine and have it do all of the same things that search can do on an Android phone, because it doesn't become preloaded. And if you try to remove search and install something else, first of all, search is still there. And secondly, that other search thing doesn't plug into all of the same places that search plugs into. And then there's a software commit from Google from a couple of years ago that makes it so that Google search is hard coded in certain situations to function in very specific ways, so that even if you have another search system installed, you can only use Google search for these specific functions. And there's a reason for that. The reason for that is that Google search is not a single app. It's not a thing that exists within the app icon when you press the search button. It's integrated into all of Google's products because Google is a search company. And so, you know, having that search function behave the same way in each one of these things was something that was important to Google. And so they made that decision so that was a consistent experience that could be offered all over the place. And that's a trend with Chrome and with the App Store as well. That sentence is important, that consistent experience. The Chrome experience is not just in the Chrome app. Twitter and just hundreds of other applications open miniature versions of Chrome inside of itself when you open a link in those applications. You open a link inside the Android version of Twitter. It's not opening a WebKit generic 1.0 thing that was just found online and slapped in there like you see on Facebook. It's a miniature version of Chrome. It uses a lot of the Chrome APIs, and it functions in very much the same way as Chrome with a bunch of the extra Flourish stuff stripped out. So when you remove Chrome, the app Chrome, from the phone, miniature versions of Chrome are still all over the place. And you run into, you know, this weird problem with this argument where it's not, there's no such thing, from my perspective, as a single removable version of Chrome and Search. And that's the assertion that the EU seems to be making, is that it's you know, it's bad for these things to be as interlocking and interdependent as they are. And Google's counter argument to that is, you know, no, we don't like that.
Which is the right argument, because A, they don't want to pay the fine, clearly, but also right. They want to make clear that just because they own 90% of the market, they are not preventing other companies from doing business.
Right, and more importantly, and it sucks that the way that Google presents this argument doesn't make this case as strong as I feel like they should. Android as a platform would be significantly less functional with Chrome and Search and the Play Store as removable things that were disconnected from everything. Android as a platform would be just so much less than it is now with that thing in existence. And it we would all be worse for it, I think.
All right. So, Martin, you've had your day of cramming to try to figure this out, but I also would love your perspective on just, as you brought up, Google is not a beloved company in much of Europe. And it's interesting to contrast it with our culture in the US, where we kind of put these tech companies on a little bit of a pedestal, especially Apple, Google, Amazon, and much, much less now Facebook, but a couple of years ago, Facebook. And what's really interesting is that it's the sort of the encroachments on our privacy, the encroachments and sort of the deliberate way that Google has insidiously found its way into all facets of our life has largely been embraced by the North American culture, I think. You know, especially around voice. You know, we talked about voice earlier, the growth of personal assistants like Google Assistant, like Alexa, and all the others. You know, those are brought into our homes voluntarily. It doesn't sound like, you know, the feelings of the European Commissioner are that divergent from the rest of the European population.
Yeah, well, I think there's no such thing as the voice of Europe, because obviously Europe is very diverse and there's a lot of people who think a lot of things in the country. But in general, I would argue that yes, what the European commissioners are arguing is more in line with the European view of the world than with the American view of the world. I think that makes a lot of sense. I read the article by Russell, and I agree that to a large extent, removing tight integrations of Google in the Android operating system would be harmful for the user experience, at least definitely on the short term. But I'm not completely convinced that means that the ruling was a bad ruling or was an incorrect ruling. So I don't think that those two things have to go together, because the European Commission doesn't legislate based on what they think is ultimately a better user experience or not. They legislate based on whether or not there is a fair and open playing space for companies to compete against each other. And what they argue is that there isn't. And I think that point is also correct. Just like Russell's point is correct that, yes, this is probably going to end up leaving us with a worse user experience, at least on the short term.
So yeah, how do you broach those two things? Because I find that argument fascinating. You know, on the one hand, Google may be too powerful, and there may be too much that the company owns, or at least has control over. But on the other hand, we've talked about how Google is an open source advocate when it comes to Android, and that it really doesn't do a lot of things on its own. It relies on partners which, like Deutsche Telekom, like a lot of the other large carriers like Samsung, like Xiaomi, they can do whatever the hell they want to the code, and they can pre-install whatever apps and services they want.
And that's why we're here today.
Right. So I mean, how do you bridge that?
I don't know how to find a balance. But what I'm arguing for is that I do understand where the legislation is coming from, because I mean, for the legislation to be correct, and I'm not saying that this will lead to a better or worse user experience, but for it to be correct, the two basic premises that we have to agree on is that Android is a monopoly, and we can debate whether it is or not, but the commission argues that it is, and that B, pre-installed and bundled applications hurt open competition. And if Android is a monopoly and pre-installing applications hurts competition, both of which the European Commission has argued that these are the cases, then absolutely Google created a playing field that is not even, right? Just imagine your Firefox or your Spotify or your whoever the service maker. For a very large group of customers, for you to reach them, the only effective way to reach them is to go through Google, right? Just to go through the Play Store and to put your apps onto Android. Because for anyone who can't afford an iPhone, there is practically no other reasonable choice that isn't Android. So for any company to want to target those users, the only way to do so is to be a second-rate app on the Google Play Store, right? And of course, it is much easier now to change your defaults. And I do commend Google for not making it harder than it has to be to, you know, replace your default apps and for allowing competition on their platform, which I think is great. But in the end, Android holds a monopoly over a certain price range of phones that is pretty much undeniable. They just have the advantage here.
Thank you. That was very well stated. I agree with every word you just said.
there's a lot to unpack there. So I want to bring Jerry into this, because what I find so interesting is right now I'm using a Galaxy S9, and I've been using this phone after going from a Pixel 2. I used an iPhone 10 for a while. I went to a BlackBerry Key 2. I've used a bunch of Motorola and Sony phones. And every company has a very different approach to how it integrates Google services. The only, except for the iPhone, obviously, the only common denominator is that they all do come with Google services bundled. But even though Samsung is the most popular Android manufacturer in the world by a large margin. And we may not be able to say that for much longer. Huawei, Vivo, and Oppo are nipping at its heels. But for now, Samsung still sells more Android phones than any other company. The default browser on a Samsung phone is the Samsung Internet browser. It's not Chrome. Bixby is not hidden. In fact, there's a hardware button to promote the alternative to Google Assistant, which is increasingly becoming the front end for Google Search. Samsung no longer really promotes Galaxy apps because it's a terrible experience, but it hasn't removed Galaxy apps from its phones. It still has that front end as a way to push some of its own services and update its native apps like S Pen and other sort of productivity services. There's the option of logging into a Samsung account, which then gives you cloud access to upload your photos, your documents, to sync information across devices. I mean, Samsung has built a parallel platform on top of Android just for Samsung products. So when we talk about the three services, the three apps that the commission is pointing out, specifically the Play Store, Chrome, and Search, it's really Search that is, to me, the most dominant factor in this, right? We've seen Microsoft and Yahoo used to be on Android, but Microsoft has its own, you know, Bing app. There is no real other competitor, DuckDuckGo, I guess. But to me, that is really, Martin, where the dominance lies, not necessarily with the Play Store and with Chrome.
I'd argue it's all of them, especially the Play Store. There is simply no other good place to get all of your apps from. And I'm not a developer, so I'm not completely sure how this works. But as far as I know, a lot of apps rely on various Google Play services. So even if you were to just like put an APK into another store, I'm not sure how you could make a competitor to that in a simple way. But yeah, I mean, search is definitely also one of the monopolies that they have.
And Martin, are you sure you only looked into this for 2 hours? Because that's absolutely correct too.
It was more like 5 hours.
Okay, it's Google is stuck between a rock and a hard place. I do think Martin is correct. Google holds a monopoly, and they are forcing services that people may not want. I don't think there's any question of that. And while the ruling of the EU may make the platform worse, you can't say it's wrong. I would use all Google services, even if I lived in the EU, and I know many people would, but they're forced on you, and that's a problem. But they have to be. And you blame the Samsungs and the LGs and the Huaweis and all the other companies that make a $90 smartphone and then never care about it. And the user expects to be able to install apps that work. Google gives developers a set of APIs, public APIs that they can use. Those APIs depend on specific things to be in specific places. They've had to go a step further and develop Play services to try to get newer style features to work with the half of Android phones that are nothing like your Galaxy S9. Because the company that made them does not care to offer these new features, but will certainly advertise them for their newer phone. And if I were a developer, I could use the APIs that know that Chrome is in place or Search is in place and write my app, or I could write my own web browser and my own search engine and include it in my app if I need to search for anything. If I don't do that, my app isn't going to work on phones that don't have Chrome and don't have Search. Google has an app store, and I'm iffy on Google Play. I mean, I don't see a problem with Google Play being very prominent on an Android phone. That's just me. But if you go to Google Play with your phone, you expect the applications there to work. For them to work, the people that made the phone either have to have ensured they've included everything that Google has to offer and it's up to date, or you have to have stuff pre-installed. It's the exact same as Internet Explorer in Windows Millennium. You had to have it or things don't work.
Right. So there are a bunch of dependencies that come with Google Play services. Now, Russell, who had to leave, so he won't be chiming in, but he said that these dependencies are there for a reason. They are there to make Android a better experience. They're there to side update things that the carriers and the OEMs don't want to do. They don't want to invest the resources, so Google has to do it on its own.
That, and do you remember the Bing phone? I doubt it made it to Canada.
I don't think so. I remember the Facebook phone.
Samsung sold a Galaxy device that had Google search removed. Well, not removed, but hidden in favor of Bing. It was horrible. It was horrible because Bing wasn't installed and developed in a way that any app could use it as part of the operating system. If you look at your Android phone, search is part of the operating system. It's not a standalone app. That's Russell said that, and he's absolutely right. And because it's part of the Android system, it can do more. It can share information. It doesn't have to, you know, it's not stuck in the same sandbox an application is. And if you remove search and make it a standalone application, you're not going to be able to use Google search to search your contacts from the phone dialer. You're not going to be able to have that cross-compatibility. It's gone.
Okay, so Martin, here's the alternative argument. If Google made its own phones and sold them exclusively, so if they only made a Pixel and they only sold that phone under its own branding, and their partners were basically stuck with the option of using AOSP and loading up their own kind of white-labeled alternatives to the Play Store and Chrome and Search, the commission would have no problem. But those companies like Samsung and, you know, Huawei and them would not want that experience because they need the software layer to be as robust as possible so that their hardware can differentiate without having to really build up their own robust software experiences. Now, how do we balance that? Because Google is providing Android for free, and all it's saying is if you want to use Play Store, Search, and Chrome, you have to agree to a bunch of these rules, including making search prominent. So what is the remedy here for Google? How do they fix this problem?
I don't have a simple remedy for this. I think this ruling came a little too late, and at least in the sense that the entire Western or non-Chinese Android ecosystem and app ecosystem and hardware ecosystem has specialized in doing things that Google doesn't do, because Google just took over a big part of the development of around the OS and their services and their APIs. But I think the interesting way to look at this would be to take a look at China, because if you think about it, China is one gigantic experiment, if we want to put it that way, where an entire country of 4 billion people live completely away from Google's services and APIs. And I would argue they have one of the most competitive hardware ecosystems and also internet services ecosystems. And I would argue that their ecosystem is both worse and better off without Google, depending on how you look at it. So the way I put it is that in terms of operating system quality in general, not having Google has obvious downsides, as we already discussed. But in a way, removing Google from this picture kind of gives oxygen to a lot of other companies to compete and to bring out their own solutions and to bring value to consumers in other ways. So if you take a look at Xiaomi, for example, I recently made a video about their business model. I don't know if you, I'm sure you guys heard that they said they limit their profits to 5%, their hardware profits.
We've talked about that on the show. It's a really interesting idea.
Yeah, and the whole reason why they can do that is that they never made money selling hardware. They never want to make money selling hardware. Their entire business model relies on them having the Xiaomi App Store, them having Xiaomi Cloud, Xiaomi Music streaming services, Xiaomi whatever the hell it is, and capturing those are basically pure profit. I heard from multiple phone makers in China that having an app store is basically just printing money for an OEM, because you practically as long as you make like a somewhat decent storefront for it, you just provide bandwidth and then collect money. So in a lot of sense, in a lot of ways, if you let OEMs capture the profits off of the internet services that Google is currently capturing the profits off of, you could argue that these OEMs can make their phones a lot cheaper than they can with Google sitting on top there. So I mean, that's one argument, counter argument that you could make. And I would argue that also, I think Chinese apps have, and the Chinese internet services ecosystem has kind of found a way around the lack of having a strong central, I don't know, authority or like a shepherd in the operating system. And if you take a look at things like WeChat, for example, right? Everyone talks about how WeChat is a super application. And I think this is arguably one of the most innovative app models. I think a big reason for why WeChat can exist and why super applications can exist is because Google, Android in China doesn't have Google there and doesn't have the connecting tissues and the APIs and the whatever's needed to keep things together. So Chinese people have found a way around it where they pack all the functionality and all the connecting tissues into an app, which is WeChat. And they let services access, you know, your identity, whatever it is that they need to access through the app. So while I wouldn't argue that that's a better system than what we have, I'd actually argue that when I lived in China, I disliked the Chinese app ecosystem and OS system quite a lot. But I don't know if that's because, I mean, from a user perspective, but I don't know if that's because I'm just so used to our ecosystem and that one isn't tailored for me, or because it's objectively worse. And what I'd argue is that it really depends on your priorities, right? If you value A, fair competition, and B, I don't know, maybe cheaper hardware or more possibilities on the app ecosystem front, then maybe removing Google from this equation a little bit might make more sense and might lead to better results. But if you value consistency and the lack of fragmentation and a baseline of quality and trust that Google provides to this ecosystem, then obviously keeping Google there is what you would prefer. So I think the argument that having Google equals good and not having Google equals bad is not necessarily true.
Well, WeChat's a great example because they are so successful because Tencent, the I don't want to say owner, they're the developers, they control the WeChat ecosystem because it's payments and messaging and everything. Tencent spends the time and money to make WeChat work with everything. If you were to take Google Play out of the picture, and Samsung phones got their apps from a Samsung store, and LG did the same, and Google still made a phone and had Google Play, you would need developers like Tencent Holdings that are willing to support all of those different stores and different methods and different APIs. And if that were true and more developers were willing to do that, I think, you know, that may be a better experience. At least you would have more choice in your experience.
Yeah.
But I, 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 I think the history tells us that if we want to continue the way we are and know that there's an app for everything, that needs Google to stay in the picture just as they are, I don't know how they're going to solve this with the EU.
So, Martin, you know, you brought up this good point about like disintermediating the Google services from Android is something that the Chinese market necessitates, right? Android is just the baseline, you know, bunch of code that everybody just builds on top of. But we know that Android works fine on without Google services because we've seen forks like Fire OS be fairly successful over the years. And you know, we were able to hack together Android support on Chrome long before it had official Play Store support. So, you know, there were things that we were doing and things that developers were doing to sort of test the limits of what a Google-less Android looked like and operated like. What I find really fascinating is that, you know, this is only focusing on three services, and arguably they are the most powerful and most profitable services that Google owns. They're, at least they facilitate Google's biggest business, which is ads. But the you know what I when I think about Samsung's Galaxy Apps Store, for instance, did it fail because Google bullied it into being a second player, a second tier player? Or did it fail because the developer community did not want to invest in a second app ecosystem, a second app store? It didn't want to maintain its apps in two separate places. That it found the Play Store as the primary way to distribute its content. Right? It's a chicken or egg thing. Google is in a situation where it's so powerful, and the Play Store is such a good product that developers may not want to put their stuff anywhere else. And in the case of China, they have to. They have no choice because Google Play Store doesn't exist there.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's absolutely a chicken and egg thing, which is why I'm saying that I think this legislation in a lot of ways came way too late. There's no good solution at this point. I completely understand where it is coming from. I completely understand that even today, the landscape to a lot of people is uncompetitive and unfair. And I understand that a legislator would want to step in there and set things straight. But I also don't see tons of people, consumers, who would be willing to, leave Google's suite of apps behind to move to another solution. And I also don't see developers doing the same to move over to, I don't know, a Samsung App Store or whatever. But at the same time, if that is the case, then there's nothing for Google to lose, because if this will be opt-in to get the whole bundled app services, and everyone will just choose those bundled app services to begin with because they're so much superior, then, I mean, maybe that's just it. You set it straight legally. Google gets a slap on the wrist, and then in the end, they win all the traffic anyway.
Yeah, I think the solution will be much like Microsoft's solution, where during the initial setup, you can choose if you want Chrome, for example. And if you choose no, you just won't see it. It's still installed. It's just not going to be presented to you, which will satisfy the EU. It's going to be more interesting when the EU starts to take on Google Play services, because that's not that easy to fix. And yeah, that'll be next.
I agree. And I mean, I feel like part of this goes beyond just the practicality of what will Google do in this specific situation. How will they bundle their services? What will, they have to present when there's a setup screen? I think part of what this signals to Google, which I also generally agree with, is that they have become so incredibly dominant in so many industries, and they have a long history of being for a corporation of their size being very open and very cooperative, much more so than Microsoft was back in the days. But still, with their size, I think every large organization who has multiple monopolies intrinsically feels like they want to start using those monopolies to get new monopolies, right? And I yeah. think you see like microaggressions from Google in a lot of ways. And maybe this you know, bundling Play services and Chrome and search with Android is just one of them. But you could argue that them doing, you know, denying quality access to YouTube on Amazon products, or how, I don't know, some of their websites like Google Earth advanced functionality only work in Chrome, or I'd argue that even the fact that they invested into KaiOS, I feel like that's a way to control a potential eventual competitor to their Android ecosystem. And they do a lot of these small actions, which I feel they wouldn't be as comfortable doing if they had received a serious, you know, legal pushback from being anti-competitive. So this might have like a spillover effect, which might mean that Google will become more careful in the future. And we've seen Microsoft do this, right? We've seen them becoming way less aggressive about putting competitors out of the business and suing companies and whatever after they went through the whole ordeal in 2001.
Jerry, one of the kind of one of the veiled threats that Sundar Pichai made in his blog post responding to the commission's release is that he says, so far, the Android business model has meant that we haven't had to charge phone makers for our technology right. or depend on a tightly controlled distribution model. But we are concerned that today's decision will upset the careful balance that we have struck with Android, and that it sends a troubling signal in favor of proprietary systems over open platforms. Now, to me, that reads like, if push comes to shove, they may not be able to keep Android free, or at least in Europe, they may have to charge OEMs for access to Android in order to avoid the, you know, the scrutiny that's being placed on it. And even if it's just a formality, even if it's just a €1 charge to get rid of this notion that Google has a monopoly through its free and open distribution of Android, that does send sort of a signal that what the EU really wants is it either wants Google to take ownership over Android, or it just wants the whole thing to be blown wide open.
Yeah, I would not be surprised to see Google release, you know, that's not the correct word, but for there to be a paid version of Android for OEMs to use in the EU. And that's because Google profits from having search embedded. Not only do we get a better experience, but Google makes money. And they can afford to lose money developing Android because they make money from every phone that uses it. If they no longer are making that money, they may tell Samsung, well, for phones that you want to sell in the EU without search embedded, it's going to cost $7 per unit. Or, you know, I can actually see Google having to do that to maintain the level of income that they have now. Not that they can't afford to lose a little bit of money, but they won't want to. So that was definitely a veiled threat, and it's a valid response. The EU doesn't want to punish Google for trying to make money. They want to punish Google for the way they're trying to make money. So Google would have to find an alternative way to make money.
And this is not the first fine levied against Google, obviously.
Oh, no.
You know, last year, the EU fined them $2.8 billion for its monopolistic practices around shopping. Around, you know, they prioritized their own and their partners' search results when people were searching for e-commerce and travel. And in some cases, and that fine stemmed from a complaint 10 years earlier around how a small UK-based travel company had to basically go out of business because they had such good SEO that they were always in the top few choices right. when it came to shopping results for flights. And Google all of a sudden decided that they weren't worth promoting to the first page, and their page rank tumbled, and so did their revenue. So Google has enormous control. And that, you know, Martin, you said it very well. You know, they are, I disagree with the concept that they're a monopoly, because they're not. I mean, a monopoly is a single entity that has control over an entire ecosystem, and they don't operate in a silo. You can still buy competitors' products in Europe, but
can I challenge this?
Yeah, of course, please. I'm not particularly, you know, well versed in this, but from my understanding of monopolistic practices, that is not what they're doing.
Okay, so I'm not a lawyer, so obviously this might be slightly incorrect, but from my understanding, a monopoly doesn't require a company or a product to be literally the only option that you can possibly buy or build solutions on or anything. What it means is that for a certain group of people, hopefully a large group of people or a large group of companies, it is the only reasonable choice without a reasonable substitute. And I think in this sense, Android is totally a monopoly, because for any consumer who doesn't have more than, I don't know, maybe $400 or however much it costs to buy the cheapest iPhone, that wants to have a smartphone, there's literally no reasonable alternative on the market that is not Android. For any carrier that wants to sell a phone below this price range, there's literally no reasonable product to sell except for phones that run Android. And for any OEM that wants to make smartphone hardware who is not called Apple, there's literally no reasonable choice for an operating system that is not Android. So in this sense, I think it absolutely is a monopoly, not a complete literal. There is no single, you know, there's always Sailfish and some open whatever, but as a reasonable choice for the average consumer, carrier, and OEM, there's effectively no choice on the market. So I absolutely think it's a monopoly.
Daniel, when I was in high school, is when they had to break up Bell telephones, you know, Ma Bell. And I had a teacher who explained it to us that, because we questioned that too, because the word monopoly was being thrown around, and we're like, doesn't that mean that there's no competition? But there's obviously competition. And he said that a monopoly is any company that has enough influence to get its own way and starts to do it.
Right. So the definition of a monopoly is that there is a single company or provider of a supplier or commodity, right? Like there is, and the issue that I have with the term monopoly when it comes to Google is not that it is not a dominant entity in the mobile operating system space, but that the way that the EU is positioning them is that they are making it impossible for companies to offer their services in a reasonable manner on Android. So that is the position that they're making, that the dominance of the Play Store plus search plus Chrome makes it categorically impossible, or at least it's so hard that the carriers and OEMs have nothing. They're basically like hitting their heads against a brick wall if they want to promote alternatives to those three sources.
I think something there is that, and Martin said earlier, if I write an Android app, if I want to be able to make any money or get any exposure, I have to use Google's Play Store. And also, if I want access to any of the services that people like about an Android phone, I have to use Play Services. I have to. I have no choice. And that, I think, is a problem in the eyes of the EU.
So the problem the EU has is that Google has forced hardware manufacturers to sign agreements, or reportedly has forced them to sign agreements to A, not fork Android if they do sign up for the Android the suite of 11 apps plus Play services, or that they have paid these manufacturers to include Google Search as the primary search app, right? So those do, I mean, that does smack of monopolistic behavior in a way that, you know, we're seeing the distribution of Android being more Googleized, even though Android itself should have nothing to do with Google being an open source project. I will agree with you on that. But the definition of there is no alternative is just, that's just objectively wrong. And I think we're talking semantics here.
Right.
And I agree with Martin that they, it's more monopolistic than not. But if we're, and we're not just talking about the iPhone as being the only competitor here. But I don't agree with the fact that, like, if you wanted an Android phone that is all Microsoft services, Android Central has a guide on how to do that, right? We can help you download Bing. We can help you install Microsoft Office. We can help you run the Microsoft Launcher. That ostensibly hides as much of Google's own services, including Chrome and Search, as possible. And that, to me, makes it possible for Google to get away from this accusation of a monopoly.
Maybe, maybe not. That's a good example. Was it the Galaxy S8 that Microsoft sold in their stores? I believe it was the Galaxy S8 that had all their services. When you turned it on, the defaults and on the homepage were still Chrome and Search, the Play Store, Play Music. That's what you had to see.
Yeah. It's in the Google Play Services agreement, right? Like, if you have the Google Play Services, the front screen has to show the whatever icons, and I'd actually challenge the base of this argument again. I think what the EU is punishing or suing Google for is not that they have a monopoly. They are claiming that if Android, together with its bundled services, are an effective monopoly, which they argue that it is, then Google has to provide an even playing field for alternative service providers. If it weren't a monopoly, like Apple isn't a monopoly, they could do whatever the hell they would want, because the consumer could simply choose not to use their platform. But they argue that there is no effective alternative to Android within a certain price range for certain OEMs, for certain carriers, for whatever it is. And therefore, because Google is in this unique position of being effectively the only choice to the consumer, they can't afford to have these bundled apps so prominent in the OS, even if getting rid of them and replacing them is relatively simple. Because I think they argue that even like a slight disadvantage means a lot and means a very uneven playing field for, I don't know, Spotify or for Firefox or for DuckDuckGo or for whoever who will never get traction. Because if the, like, we know this, that for you and me, you know, replacing apps is simple, and, you know, anyone can go and replace their apps, and it's way simpler than it was in the Microsoft days. But still, being the default gives you a very, very large advantage. And since Google has the monopoly on a large part of the market, they should not be allowed to have such an unfair advantage. I think this is how I'd correct it.
And that is a very, very powerful and valid argument. What's interesting And you know, part of me agrees with you, even though I use Google services over the competitors anyway. But the really interesting part is that the EU is the sole organization in the world that views these tech companies this way, right? The EU was one of the first companies to take Facebook to task for the Cambridge Analytica scandal. It has constantly been a vociferous voice against the dominant powers of just a few tech companies. And yet the American equivalent of the European Commission finds no problem with the nature of the Android iPhone or Android iOS duopoly.
That's because Facebook and Google pay them millions of dollars a year in donations.
In lobbying.
Yes, and that's the fundamental difference between the West. And, you know, Canada's a lot more like the United States than it is the EU. The EU sometimes, I think, is overprotective. And I think this is one of those cases. There is a balance that could be made, and there should have been, you know, this should have been done a long time ago, and expectations should have been set, and both sides should have determined what's best for the people in Europe. But it's too late for that now. Maybe they're overprotective sometimes, but at least they're semi-neutral and trying to look out for the welfare of their citizens without any corporate influence.
Hmm. I'd argue that they have plenty of corporate influence as well.
Oh, see? It's not popularized like
but
it
not,
is.
Maybe not as, not as pronounced as it is in the US. I mean, also the other obvious argument is that the EU simply has very few competitors to these giant tech corporations. So it simply feels less of a need to protect its own dominant position in an industry,
maybe,
right?
Maybe.
Having the top four or five most powerful companies in the world in your country, I think it's a strategic interest of the US to keep those companies powerful and dominant across the world.
That's a good point.
I think for Europe, there's no strategic importance in keeping Google powerful, right?
What's interesting is that you actually made a video about the weakening ecosystem of tech companies in Europe and yeah. how with the death, I wouldn't call it necessarily a death, but the decline of Nokia. In the late 2000s and into the 2010s, you know, we see the European tech ecosystem playing a much less important role in the future of mobile, especially, even though some of the biggest, like Deutsche Telekom owns T-Mobile, right? There's a huge presence from the carrier side of things. And many of the biggest carriers in the world are owned by European companies, or are European companies. But when it comes to R&D and innovation, you're not seeing it as much anymore. And I wonder, if the European Commission would be as heavily scrutinizing a European company that had this dominance. And I really don't have any skin in the game one way or the other, but it does seem like there seems to be a particular edge when it comes to criticizing American companies in the EU.
I think that's true. I also think that isn't necessarily a problem in the sense that if nobody will do it, somebody has to do it. And I think obviously we've come to the point where a lot of these large tech companies have to be regulated in one way or another, because they have become so yes. incredibly powerful that if you don't regulate them, eventually this will lead to even more problems, right? We were just saying that maybe this regulation came too late, if anything. It's very difficult for me to imagine that the US will have very strong regulations on their own tech companies. It is even more difficult for me to imagine that China will regulate its own tech companies in the way that we in the West would like to see them regulated. And so if Europe has no real stakes in them, then maybe it's better for, maybe not everyone, but a lot of people including non-Europeans, that Europe regulates these companies.
Well, that's a very interesting idea, because we just saw the United States have very little regard for Huawei or ZTE, because they would compete and take away from an American business, and there's no American money at stake. So they were treated very differently.
Yep.
So that's an interesting take.
Quite an obvious comparison, no?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm interested in why Europe is not regulating ZTE and Huawei and not scrutinizing them in the same way as the US is. But I guess that's a topic for another day.
Yeah.
Well, at least the British government is warning against companies using Huawei and ZTE hardware, but there's no regulation or there's nothing is preventing the carriers or any of the retailers from selling those products in the UK the way that they are in America. Anyway, that is definitely another topic for another day, because we could probably talk about it for another hour and a half. But we are coming up on an hour and a half, and I think we're going to end this incredibly interesting discussion here. Martin, it has been so wonderful having you. Thank you for your insight. Thank you for your intelligence, your patience. If I could have you on every week, I would, because you bring a very, very level-headed and I think a very nice foil to what we typically talk about, which is a very American or North American specific focus. And Jerry, I think you'd agree with that.
Oh yes, this was awesome. Thank you so much, Martin.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was a lot of fun.
So, Martin, where can people find you if they want to learn more about you and watch your videos?
I am Tech Altar everywhere. So YouTube is my main channel, youtube.com/TechAltar. I'm also on Twitter and on Facebook and Instagram. Those are my three main channels. And for anyone who's interested in EU-related topics, I'm actually working on two related topics, I guess. One is my next video will be on KaiOS, like a deep dive into how it works and the business strategy behind it and why Google invested money into them and how that will play out, in my opinion, which I think is related. My one after that will be focusing specifically on European, I haven't decided if tech companies or smartphone companies, but there's so little talk about them, and I think they're so, just nobody knows about them. I think it's an interesting topic because there are a few cool companies that I'd like to highlight.
Amazing. Yeah. And we'll post a link to your channel in the show notes. So thank you again, Jerry, as always. It's awesome. And Russell, he had to bounce a while back, but he would also express his thanks. If you've been listening, thank you so much. We appreciate you sticking around. And as always, we will see you next week. So take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ciao.